But let's look at another question. We've had a Declaration of Human Rights which was approved by the General Assembly in 1948. We ought to set before our hearers, Thebla, the difference between the problem of the Declaration and the covenant which is now being discussed.
What I would stress here is not so much the difference as the danger of exaggerating too much this difference. The Declaration was, in my opinion, an aim, an ideal. But the covenant, it means a convention, binding governments to give to their citizens such and such rights, is also not only a statement of what rights the citizens have now, in this very moment. You have in the covenant, in the very beginning, a very important point, which reads, where not already provided for by existing legislative or other measures, each state undertakes to take the necessary steps in accordance with this constitutional processes and with the provisions of this covenant to adopt within a reasonable time such legislative or other measures as may be necessary to give effect to the rights recognized in this covenant. It means that we expect governments as representatives of their peoples to undertake to give more rights then maybe at this very moment all the citizens of those states who are supposed to sign in joint.
Yes, I think you're right in emphasizing this similarity, this continuity. The Declaration was a statement of moral purpose. The covenant is an attempt to set up the legal machinery to implement that in the form of a treaty,
okay,
which must be ratified by the individual states. We've been talking, however, about declarations, covenants, about the things people say. How about what the United Nations has done? What are the operations? How has the United Nations advanced in concrete action the interests of human rights?
Well, the United Nations, ever since the beginning of the organization, that is to say, during the Conference of San Francisco, was very, very much concerned with the question of human rights. And it was with general satisfaction that the provisions of the Charter in connection with human rights were adopted at San Francisco. But no sooner the different organs of the United Nations began to work that they had before them cases in which the problems of human rights were directly attacked and had to be faced by the organization. For instance, we had at the beginning, we had in the General Assembly and in the Security Council different cases which raised the question of what action could the United Nations take in connection with human rights.
Yes, I think it's well also to look at the large history of the United Nations. Here in a period of a little more than 5 years, hundreds of millions of people have come into at least the right to self-determination and self-government. People of India, Pakistan, Indonesia, the Philippines. That would have been impossible without the United Nations. There's also the question, Debler, of human rights and technical assistance, the program that parallels in the United Nations the American Point Four program.
Well, we entered here really a new sphere, isn't it? I define it the rights of men as members of a collective, of a large group of men, of a people, for instance, or a citizens of a state, where, when and where the people has formed itself as a state. This is certainly very important.
Yes,
but I would disagree with you in saying that without the United Nations, the liberation of, you mentioned, of Asian peoples would have been impossible. There are two processes going parallelly.
What I said is that it would not have been as peaceful. There would have been more violence.
Maybe.
It would have been more difficult. There was a forum, a moral forum, to present the issue.
Maybe.
And I must say, as a matter of fact, that in very specific cases, the United Nations had the decisive intervention in the creation of new states. You have the case, for instance, of Israel, you have the problem of Palestine, and now the last General Assembly decided that Libya, the former Italian colony, would be independent and united state. Mm-hmm. And this is a new development in international relations. We have an international organization that creates or that promotes the establishment of independent states.
Sir, this is important, but the point I wanted to make is that without the struggle of those peoples to become independent, we couldn't have created those states. They have to fight for themselves.
Of course, the United
Nations. And I think that their liberty and the existence of the United Nations as it is, of such a charter as it is, are two sides or two phenomena of our time and show precisely the high level on which we reached already in international space.
Certainly, the United Nations cannot do something if the people themselves don't want it. But the United Nations cannot either create artificial political units if there is not the will of the people to have this unit created.
The list of contributions of the United Nations to human rights wouldn't be complete without referring to UNESCO, to the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. Among other things, that organization made a special study of human rights in cooperation with the United Nations Commission. And the book which was produced as a result of that study is the foundation of the Home Study course, which is connected with this program. If we had time, we ought to go into the practical difficulties. For example, one of the things that came up in the UNESCO discussion was that there was a difference between one group which emphasized the basic importance of economic and social rights and the group that thought that political rights were important. There are special problems with individual rights, like the right to freedom of information, the right to work and security. And there are special problems that have to do with the danger of deception. I don't want to go into those questions now, except that last one. That one I want to emphasize by pointing out that there is an extremely important strategy in the development of free men. That's illustrated by the way in which the word peace has been used. Has been used for propaganda purposes to such an extent that it becomes difficult to identify oneself with the peace movement. And instead, therefore, of talking about the means by which peace can be achieved, one looks rather to the organizations that sponsor the movement for peace. We must not permit that to be done with human rights. We must rather make that assertion of human rights which will depend upon the issue itself, and not on who sponsors the issue. It is necessary to investigate human rights, in the various parts of the world, not only, as the United Nations and the General Assembly will do, the human rights of peoples in Hungary, in Romania, in Bulgaria, of war prisoners, but also in South Africa. But let's spend our last few minutes on the question of how human rights can be enforced throughout the world. What is, in your opinion, Bebler, the relation of human rights to the whole operation of the United Nations?
Well, the United Nations certainly can do a lot. And as a believer in the strength of public opinion, I would say that the most important point is that through the United Nations, the world public opinion is being mobilized, so to speak, on such issues which really are of a great importance for the future of mankind, and for the preservation of peace. I come back to this point. I defined as rights of men as members of the people. And I would mention paragraph 2 of Article 1 of the Charter, which reads to develop friendly relations among nations based on respect for the principle of equal rights and self-determination of peoples, and to take other appropriate measures to strengthen universal peace. Here the Charter makes the link.
You're quoting here the words.
That's right, the words of the Charter. The link between strengthening universal peace and recognizing rights of man.
Arriba, how do you think concretely the United Nations can do this?
Well, The United Nations is really embarked in the very ambitious activities that will have as a result the promotion of masses of human beings all over the world to higher standards of living. And I think that this is one of the most effective ways of generalizing the respect of the human person and the safeguard of human rights.
There are positive means by which to raise standards as well as merely negative ways of rectifying deviations from human rights. Well, let's turn finally, Bedler, to the question of what is the force behind human rights? How are we going to make them operative in the world?
Well, the main force, in my private opinion, is the force of those deprived of human rights. Their will to achieve them,
and
to obtain them.
And also the public opinion of the rest of the world witnessing this deprivation.
That's also
important.
Definitely. The feeling of solidarity of those who enjoy rights and those who do not.
We have come to the end of our time without coming to the end of the question. I think that we have come to some very important agreements on the relevance and the practical utility of human rights, the need for the covenant, the need of moral solidarity, understanding and confidence in the pursuit and the acquisition, the maintenance of human rights. So these issues, which we've merely touched on, will be discussed more systematically in terms of the agreements of men, the differences of men, in the four lessons that are presented in the course on human rights, which are attached to this program. And those four lessons, with their background material, also raise questions which all of the men of the world should consider and should be able to answer if we are to survive the present crisis.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Human Rights were Aleš Bebler, Yugoslav delegate to the United Nations, Emilio N. Oriba, member from Uruguay of the United Nations Commission, and Richard McKeon, philosopher of the University of Chicago. Richard McKeon, distinguished service professor of philosophy at the University of Chicago, who served as rapporteur of the UNESCO Committee on the Philosophical Basis of Human Rights, has prepared a lesson guide for your study of the problems of human rights. The four-chapter outline of issues and questions is reprinted in full in today's roundtable pamphlet, as well as the full text of the discussion which you have heard today. You will want to order copies of this pamphlet and read the outline lesson guide and decide whether you wish to enroll for the roundtable home study course on human rights. Each month, a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica will be awarded to that registered student in human rights who completes the course in the most satisfactory manner. In this course, you can learn about the origins of major ideas on human rights, conflicting ideas on the application of universal rights, and what human rights mean in this country and the world. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of the pamphlet and the details of the human rights course. Individual copies are 10 cents in coin. Send 10 cents with your order to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. A full year subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Next week, the Roundtable pamphlet republishes the first international draft covenant on human rights. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's discussion, and thus be sure to get next week's pamphlet, too. I'll repeat the address, University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable continues this series with a discussion of how can human rights be enforced throughout the world. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.